We're holding on page 32 in Erevin Ois Lamed. The subject of the perek is about tchumim of cities, and we had a long digression from that, but now the Gemara is getting back to that, to those dinim. How do you define where the city ends as far as tchumim? So one thing is, the Gemara mentions in that connection, if you have people who live in huts or temporary things like that, then they don't count as a city unless, as the Gemara goes on to say, unless you have some permanent houses, unless you have a certain number of permanent houses there as well. So the Gemara asks, in that case then, so what about the camp in the Midbar? That was considered to be an actual camp. That was considered to be an actual permanent place, even though they were all living in tents. And the Gemara brings in this connection when it says "Vayachnu al Yarden Beis HaYishimis." In this week's parasha, when it says they were camping by the Yarden from Beis HaYishimis until Ovel HaShittim. So, how big is that area? I personally saw that area. They have a tlosi parasi or tlosa parasi. It was 3 by 3. It was 3 by 3 parasa. Parasa is around 2.5 to 3 miles. So you're talking around 8 or 9 miles on a side, 8 or 9 miles square. Marshall actually learns that maybe what it means is that each shevet, when they were traveling, took up 1 mil. So that would mean when they're camping, not necessarily are they taking up a full square of 12 by 12 mil. Apparently, Marshall learns like this. We usually, when you see pictures of how the layout of the Machna was, we usually see that you have the 12 Shevatim on the four sides and then a space between them, a space of a couple of thousand amos between them and the Mishkan. Apparently, Marshall is learning it didn't necessarily have to be that way. So it could be when they camped, it actually wasn't quite as large as 3 by 3 pyre. So although in other places, the Gemara seems to imply that it was, that actually the full side, the full space they took up when they camped, and they camped in a square, was 3 by 3. Anyway, the point is, Vitanya, we learn in a brisa, Kshein Nifnin, when people in the Midbar needed to go to the bathroom, and by the way, you know, it says, of course, about the mon, that there was Nivla Be'evorim, so they didn't have to go to the bathroom, but first of all, sometimes they bought food from Tagri Umasa'ulam, the Gemara tells us in Yoma, you had Goyish traders and peddlers going through the desert sometimes, and they would buy food from them, but besides that, it also says that after they complained the last time in Parshas Chukas about V'nafshenu Kotza B'alachim HaKloko, where one of the things they were complaining about is that says is they're complaining it's completely absorbed in the body and eventually we're going to blow up. So from then on, Hashem made that Taka, at least those people who complain, that maybe everybody, I don't know, Taka had to go to the bathroom. Be that as it may, when they went to the bathroom, a nifnin lo lifnehem, they shouldn't go in front, meaning continuing in the direction that they came from. So if let's say now they're camping in a place where previously they traveled from the south, they were heading towards the north, then let's say now they shouldn't go towards the north to go to the bathroom, below the tzidehen, or to the side, to the east or the west, elalachreyen, only back the way they came, which in this case would be south. The reason being, because they have to go outside the Anani HaKovet at any rate, but the point is that what happens if the next time they go, they might go forward from where they were, they might continue going northward, or they might go east or west, still depending on what Hashem tells them, and therefore, whichever way the Anan goes, and it wouldn't be respectful that they're going to be walking over a place that people used as a latrine. They're not going to be going backwards, so therefore they can go to the bathroom in the direction they came from. Anyway, the point is, the Gemara says, so you see from that, that such a place is considered a permanent place and it's considered a city. And the Gemara says that's different because since it's a piyashem yachnu va piyashem yiso, then it's considered permanent, even if in fact, in practice, they were only there for one night. And even though they're living in tents or sukkahs or what have you. So the Gemara goes on to talk about this point about people who live in huts like that. And you're talking about, Rashi explains, so you have, these are, for example, people who are pasturing, who are grazing their animals, so they're nomads. They'll stay in one place for a month or two until the grass is used up in that area, and then they'll move someplace else. So Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, Yoshvei Tzrifum Umahalchim Midbaris, people like that who live in these huts, a little bit here, a little bit there, or people who are traveling in the desert, same idea, where they're living in a temporary place and then moving to another temporary place. Chayehem einem chayim. Their life is not a life because they're living without a lot of the comforts of life. They never know when they're going to have to pick up and move. They're not able to have very much stuff. So Unashehim of Nahum, Enim Shalahem, and their wives and their children are not really their own, because like this, they're traveling with their families, and the Gemara is going to explain in a few lines what's in other words, the suspicion is their wives are Mizana, and therefore their children may not really be their own. The Gemara will explain soon why that is. Similarly in a Braisa, Eliezer Ish Bira Omer. Ish Bira could mean he came from a place called Bira. It could mean that sometimes in the Gemara, the word Bira means the Beis Hamikdash as a whole or a certain area in the Beis Hamikdash. So it could mean that he had something to do with that area. There's, for example, in the Gemara elsewhere, you have one of the Chacham called Ye'ezer Sara Bira, where the implication is that he was the ruler of that of the Bira or whatever. So here it might be the same thing. Anyway, he says, Yoshvei Tzrifim ki Yoshvei Kvaris, people who live in these kinds of huts are like people who live in graves. They're the next thing to dead, because again, Rashi says they're lacking a lot of hana, they're lacking a lot of the comforts of gashmiistic life, and they're exposed very much to the elements in these kinds of huts. They're very much exposed to high winds and rains and other things like that. And about their daughters, as far as a person might think to make a shidduch with one of their daughters, the pasuk says, "Cursed is the person who sleeps with any animal." So, in other words, their daughters are usur. So Rashi implies that it's the same thing as what we were just saying. We said in shame of name enam shalahem. So, in connection with that, then we're saying their daughters may be mamzerus and therefore better not to marry them. Marshall says that actually not necessarily, because the fact is, before we said Nesheim of Nehem, and all of a sudden here we're changing to Bnei Seim. And also, why are we bringing Oro Sheikhim and Kobahema rather than other psukim that show that you're not allowed to marry Mamzeim? So Marashar explains that the Tanya Nami Hachi is not going on everything we said before. We said two things. We said Chayeim Enam Chayim Un Shem of Neim Enam Shalahem. So now the Braisa is backing up the first point that Chayeim Enam Chayim, and therefore Eliezer Ishbira is expressing that by saying it's like they're living in graves. As far as the second thing, the Bnei Sehen, the problem is not because of Znus and Mamzeros or anything like that. The problem is, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, because they live in a very uncivilized way. As the Gemara is going to go on to say, they don't have bathhouses even, because they're constantly on the move. So therefore, their daughters are like, they're living in a way that's a little better than behemoths. But not, in other words, Marashah says, we're not necessarily saying there's an issur to marry them, just that it's not a good idea because they've grown to this very uncivilized way of living. So my timer, what's the problem that we said before, that the shame of name and shalahem and all that? Ula omer pnesha inlam mechatzos. Ula says because they have no bathhouses. Now, still, a person needs to bathe occasionally. So therefore, what they end up doing is they have to travel far away to go use a bathhouse. Meanwhile, Rashi describes what happens is the men have all left the encampment, so only the women are left over there. So the women have an excellent opportunity over there to be mizana with strangers who come by, and therefore there's suspicion that they taka do that. Rabbi Yochanan says a different reason, because everybody realizes when the other person is going to toivel. Meaning we're talking about Ula's explanation had to do with the men going to the bathhouses. Rabbi Yochanan's explanation has to do with Fakert, the women going to the mikveh. So what happens is, because again, the mikveh is nowhere near where they live, therefore they have to travel some distance. The women don't want to travel alone, so they invite their neighbors to come with them. Meanwhile, you have Rishoyim, men, realize now we have an opportunity to go and waylay them on the road when a couple of women are alone on the road without any men with them. If nothing else, you have a problem of yichud, Rashi says, and you may even have worse than that. This is, by the way, this Gemara over here, Magdishan Zelo Zebet Tevila, is actually one of the sources for the concept that when women go to the mikveh, they should do it in privacy. They don't publicize the fact that they're going, and that's related to what we're saying over here. So the Gemara says, "My Benayu, what's the practical difference between Ula's and Rabbi Yochanan's reasons?" The answer is, "Ikabenayu nara de mikra v'masa or de samich lebesa." If there's a river near the city or near the house, So the issue of, so you can tovel in a river, but you can't use it as a bathhouse. A bathhouse is you can have hot water over there and various other comforts like that. So the problem, sort of Yochanan's problem as far as tevilah doesn't apply. The women can just easily go to the river without having to call their neighbors to go with them, and therefore you don't have that problem. But you have Ula's problem of she'in la'im merchatzois, because still, when it's men's turn to go to the merchatz, then they all go together and leave the town without any men, and then there can be trouble with that. So we're talking about people. Yeah, it could be people who live like the Bedouins do, like they live in tents or huts or whatever, a nomadic lifestyle. Yeah, where they actually said like they're pasturing their animals in one place for a month or two, and then they pull up stakes and move to the next place. That's what we're saying. It's not a way for a yid to live. So with the exception, we said before, when the Jewish people were in the Midbar, that's different. Al-Piyashim Yachnu, Al-Piyashim Yiso. And of course they had, you know, for example, they didn't need Merchatzois. They had the well of Miriam, and their clothes were clean and pressed and so forth. So obviously we're not talking about that. Continuing on that topic of the lifestyle that a person should, what kind of place a person should and shouldn't be living in. So we said you shouldn't have people living in these nomadic lifestyles in tents or huts or whatever. So kol ir she'en bo yerek, any city where there's no vegetables available in it, and you have to remember, you know, it's not like now where they bring them in refrigerated trucks. In those days, you know, you wanted vegetables, they had to be grown someplace nearby. So if there's no vegetables, ein tamid chacham rashoi lodur b'soicha, a tamid chacham is not allowed to live in such a city, because vegetables are good, they're nutritious, and they're cheap. So that way, a tamid chacham can stretch his budget by buying vegetables and not have to spend a lot of time looking for parnasa, and this way he's able to eat nutritiously. Tosfos points out. Now we learned in Shabbos. We said that a Talmid Chacham should not eat vegetables because it whets his appetite, and then he's just going to want more. He's just going to want more food, and he can't afford it because he's living on a kol mixed budget. So on the contrary, they were saying he shouldn't eat vegetables. And you have over there, Rav Chista says, I never ate vegetables when I was poor or when I was rich. When I was poor, I couldn't afford it. And when I was rich, I figured I might as well eat meat and fish instead. So Tosfos makes the distinction that the Gemara there in Shabbos is talking about raw vegetables. Here we're talking about cooked vegetables. So raw vegetables, the problem is they stimulate your appetite, and then meanwhile he's living on a Kerlo Jungerman's budget, and he can't afford extra food. This is, you know, we have by Kairpas, by the Seder, we eat raw vegetables precisely for that reason, to stimulate the appetite. As opposed to, Tosfos says, our Gemara is talking about cooked vegetables are very good for you, they're very nutritious, and they're cheap. And they help stretch your budget nicely. So therefore, Adraba, Talmid Chacham should live in a place where there are vegetables available, and then he should cook them. Ion Yaakov points out further. He says that also here we're talking about particularly Talmid Chacham who are poor. If a Talmid Chacham is rich, then maybe Taka, he can live in a place where there aren't vegetables, because fine, like Rav Chista said, he can afford meat and fish instead. But if he's a poor Talmid Chacham, and most Talmid Chachamim are, then he should be living in a place where there are vegetables available. So the Gemara asks Meisvi, or the Memra de Yerek Malya, so you're telling me that vegetables are good for you? Well, Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Shlosha Marbinus Azevel, there are three kinds of things that a person eats that cause him to produce more waste, more excrement. The Koifinus Akoima, they cause his stature to be bent. In other words, they make him stoop. The Noitel Echon, Mechamish Meus, Memo'er Enem Shaladim, and they take away 1/500th of his eyesight. Which doesn't mean, you know, like we had before, for example, in Brachas and in Shabbos, where a person walks large steps, it also takes away 1/500th of his eyesight. We talked about there what Tosfos says. Doesn't mean if he takes 500 such steps, he's going to be blind. It can mean each time it takes away 1/500th of what's left, or it can mean only the first time it does that, and afterwards his body gets used to it. So it could be the same kind of thing over here, but still, these things have a bad effect on a person's health. The Elohein, Pas Kibber, the first one is pumpernickel bread. The Sheikha Chodosh and new beer, fresh beer, the Yerek and vegetables. So we're saying that vegetables are not good for you. So what are you telling me, that Adraba Talmid Chacham should be living in a place where there are vegetables? And the answer is like Kasha, Hobbit Tumi Vakarti, Hobbit Shar Yarki. Depends. You have in one category, there are garlic and leeks, and the other category are the other vegetables. So Rashi explains that his Rebbeim explained that the garlic and the leeks are not good for you. Those are the ones that were saying that they're migrinous as evil and so forth, and all other vegetables are good for you. Rashi says the other way around. Garlic and leeks are good for you. And in fact, he brings from a Gemara in Baba Kama that mentions a number of good things that garlic in particular does for a person. You actually have the Gemara mentions over there that Ezra made a takana that people should eat garlic on Friday night because it's Marbe Hazera. And that way, when Tamar Chachamim in particular are having relations with their wives, then this way it'll help with that. So Rashi says what the Gemara means over here is Tumi Vakarti, garlic and leeks are good for you. The other kinds of vegetables are not. Kidatanya, as in fact we learn in a Braisa, that there's a difference between those and other vegetables. A Braisa says, shum yerek, garlic is considered a vegetable, kreshin chatsi yerek, and leeks are considered a half a vegetable. So again, Rashi says, according to his Rebbeim, it would mean that garlic is really bad for you and leeks are sort of bad for you. And according to Rashi, the other way around, garlic is really good for you and leeks are so-so, they're okay, and the other vegetables are not. Continues the Braisa, nira tsnoi, nira samchayim, if you see a radish, then you see a medicinal potion. In other words, radishes, the Braisa is saying, are also good for you. They help heal whatever's wrong with you. But the Gemara asks, well, Tanya, nira tsnoi, nira samamavas, doesn't another Braisa say the opposite? If you see radishes, then you're seeing a poison. And the answer is like Hashel, kanba olin, kanba imoris. There's a difference between the leaves and the bulbs. So Rashi says the leaves of the radishes are no good for you, but the radish bulb, which is the part that you actually buy in the store and generally is what you eat, that's good. The root of it, that's good for you. And can be moisachamim. Furthermore, there's also a difference between the summer and the winter. In the summer, they're good for you because they help cool down your body. In the winter, they're bad for you because it's already cold out. You don't want to cool down your body still further. So it comes out, in other words, from Rashi, you've got leaves versus roots, and you've got summer versus winter. The only ones that are good for you are only the roots, and only during the summer. So the leaves would always be bad for you. On the other hand, Tosfos disagrees with that. And brings a different Gemara that implies that it's good to have radishes both in summer and in winter. So he says, what it means is between the leaves and the roots, one of them is good for you in the summer, the other one is good for you in the winter. And then he brings another Girsa that it's actually three of the four possibilities are good for you. The roots always and the leaves, and the leaves dafka during the summertime. So different possibilities of what exactly it is as far as radishes, which ones are good for you and which ones are not. Bechlal, I guess, when the Gemara mentions Yerek, sometimes it means, I guess, a little bit of a narrower category, or I guess in a way a little narrower, in a way a little wider than what we think of as vegetables. Because here we're saying, for example, garlic is included, and I don't think, you know, you usually think of garlic as a vegetable per se. On the other hand, I don't know, for example, would the Gemara be including vegetables that are actually for the fruit of their respective plant, like cucumbers or tomatoes? Would the Gemara necessarily be including that in this category? I don't know. Sometimes in Gemara terminology, yerek means specifically the leaves of the plant, as opposed to you have the various other parts of the plant that are edible. Bechlal, I mean, to a certain extent, of course, these things depend on different times and different places. The Rambam gives his own take. On these things based on the medical science of his times, and we say Nishtanu Ativim, so not all of these things necessarily apply, at least not in the Gashmistic sense nowadays. The Gemara continues, another point about places where it's good to live and not. Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, Kol Ir Sheyeshba Milus Umodus, a city that has a lot of ups and downs, that has very steep hills, Odom of Behema Sheba Mason Bachatzi Yameim. The people and the animals in such cities die at half their normal life expectancy. What do you mean? They don't actually die at their house. You see that there were people who lived to good old ages in such cities. They become prematurely old from all the schlep of going up and down. And in fact, Amar of Huna Breja of Yeshua, Hai Mu Yosa de Biri or de Neresh, for example, the hills and the ups and downs between Bay Biri and Bay Neresh, which Rashi says are two towns in Bavel, where there's steep slopes between one and the other, as Kunun, those made me prematurely old, walking back and forth between one and the other. This is Rav Huna Breja of Yeshua said that about Bay Biri and Neresh. So he used to travel back and forth between one and the other of them, and he says that made him prematurely old. Okay, further on in the Perek, it talks about, now the Mishnah had said that when you're coming to measure Tumim, you're supposed to use a rope 50 amos long. Specifically a rope made out of linen threads. So the Gemara says, Tanya, the Gemara has a discussion before this about, is it so, or should it be made out of a different material? So Tanya, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, Ein l'chosha yofel medina yos mishal shaloiz shabazel. The truth is, there's nothing better for measuring distances like that than iron chains, because a rope can stretch or shrink depending on the weather. In fact, there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia that tells us you have to be careful about that. The Gemara cautions over there that a surveyor has to be careful. He can't, for example, measure out land for one person in the summertime and for a different person in the wintertime, where, let's say, imagine, for example, they're dividing up a field between Yoshim and whatever, because sometimes the rope is going to be longer than others, and therefore you're going to end up, one of them is going to end up getting shortchanged. So the best thing, really, Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya says, would really be iron chains, because those don't stretch. But what can we do? Because the Pasuk describes Zechariah sees a malach who's going to measure your shalayim of Asid Lavoi, and he sees him with a linen, he sees him with a rope, and he asks him, what are you going to do? He says, I'm going to measure your shalayim. And then Zechariah says, I heard Hashem telling another malach, go tell him, no, you don't need to measure it. Prozis teish of your shalayim. That's where the expression comes from that Pasuk in Zechariah. So the point is, we see in the Pasuk that a rope is being used for measuring. So therefore, Rabbi Yeshua says that, look, you know, fine, you want to use an iron chain, gesunta heit, but we can't pass all a rope, given that you have precedent in the pasuk to use one. Rashi actually says that the pasuk we're referring to is when Yechezkel is describing the third Beis Hamikdash, which has man grama we've been learning now. However, Tosfos points out that actually that pasuk of Yadur Chevel Midah is in connection with that pasuk in Zechariah, and therefore instead by Yechezkel we said Malach was holding Knei Hamidah, a measuring stick. Other Mephoshim point out that in fact there's a different girsa that there can be in the Gemara over here, rather than over Yadur Chevel Midah, you have the Loshon HaPasuk in Yechezkel is also over Yadur Ish Psil Pishtin, that the man is holding the Malach, who appeared as a man, is holding a linen rope. So we see there also that a linen rope is being used for measuring the lengths of the walls and things like that in the third Beis Hamikdash. So again, the point is that you have precedent for using that rather than iron chains. The Gemara continues, Tani Rab Yosi, or Rab Yosef, Gimel Chavolim Heim. There are three different kinds of ropes that are used for different purposes in Halacha. And why is this a piece in Ein Yaakov? Habona at the bottom of the page points out, you know, the word midah means not just measuring, it means also a midah, like a midah tova, or the opposite that a person might have. It goes to show that you don't just always measure yourself or other people when necessary using the same midah, depending on what you're measuring, depending on what you need to measure, use the appropriate midah for the purpose. Don't just think I have one tool, you know, you have, as the expression goes, you know, you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Don't think like that. Realize that everything has its own midah, its own way of measuring. Anyway, shel megig, you have, number one, there's a rope made out of megig, which is a type of grass, v'shel nitzorim, or of nitzorim. Here in Ein Yaakov, there's printed only one part of the Rashi that says nitzorim means peeled arava branches. In the Gemara, as printed in the Rashi, as printed in the Gemara, it gives another explanation that nitzorim is a type of vine that grows around the bottom of palm trees. Anyway, that's a second kind of rope. Shall pishdan, and then you have a rope made out of linen. Shall megag lapara, the one made out of grass or reeds, is used for tying up the parah adruma. Kedetnan, if you learn in Mishnayis parah, kafsua b'chevel amegag, they would tie up the parah adruma using a rope made out of this kind of grass. V'nasnua gav ma'arachta, and then they would place it on the wood pile where they're going to shecht it and burn it to make the parah adruma ashes. The point is that the point is that such a rope is not makabel truma, and you want everything involved in making the parah aduma should be something that's not makabel truma. Tosfos points out, really, when you get down to it, ropes are not makabel truma b'chlal. But the point is that we want not only a rope of any kind would not be makabel truma, but they wanted to use a kind where even the material it's made from cannot be makabel truma, which is true of these grasses. It's a chumri yaseira, as usual, by the parah aduma. Maile yaseira also by parah. Next, shal nitzorim b'soita. Then you have the second kind made out of nitzorim, which again means either peeled arava branches or this vine that grows around palm trees. That's used for the soita, the tanan, as you have the Mishnah in soita, that it mentions over there how the koyin goes and rips the soita's clothing, and then afterwards, so her dress doesn't fall off. Maybe chevel mitzri. Then he brings a mitzri rope, the koshal, and he ties it above her breast so her dress doesn't slip off. So on the simple, we would assume that mitzri means a rope from Mitznayim, and there are, and in fact, it does bring over there that there is a certain symbolism in it. The Gemara says, he osa maisa Mitznayim, she acted immorally, or at least there's a strong suspicion that she did, like the way the Mitzriim did, and therefore there's a chevel on mitzri, but it doesn't actually mean necessarily a rope from Egypt. It means mitzri, meloshen mitzorim, as we're saying over here. And the third one, shall pishta l'medida, then you have a rope made out of linen, whereas the Gemara is saying over to you, you use that for measuring the tchumen, and as Yechezkel has it for measuring the third base mikdash, and as Zechariah has it to measure your shalayim, and then to not measure your shalayim, because pros the stage of your shalayim. Okay, on to Yechezkel now. We are holding Perek Mem Poser Mem Dalad. So we started talking about that yesterday. We started learning after Yechezkel went through the description of all the gates of the Chotzer Achitzoyna and of the Chotzer Apnimis. So now we started talking about that there's the area where they shecht and skin the korbanos. So we said you have eight tables inside the gate complex over there where they would shecht. You have the base on the base on the lushka samadichin, which is that C-shaped thing next to the mizbeach, where they would wash the parts of the korbanos that need to be washed. In there were hooks also where they would hang up the animal to skin it. So now he continues, Pasuk Mem Dalad, and also he says there were tables over there to place the shchita knives and other things that they're going to need for the shchita and kabbalah. So now he continues, umichutza lashar apnimi. Outside of the inner gate, which means Rashi says, when we say outside, we mean outside the whole complex of the gate. So you have the whole gate and the whole entryway and the ulam and all of that. So outside that, inside the chotzer apnimi, meaning in other words, so we would just describe it saying inside the chotzer, but it means in other words, outside. You shouldn't think it's someplace inside the gate complex. It's completely outside next to the northern gate, you have chambers for the singers. So you have in the Beis Mikdash, you had the Levim who sang, and you had the people who played instruments, the three-way machlokas in the Mishnah in Erchin, who played the instruments, whether it was also Levim, whether it was Yisraelim, or whether it could be even Avodim. In the second Beis Hamikdash, the way they had it is you had the steps in front of Shaul Nikonor that you see over there, the round steps on the Poroches. On either side of the steps, underneath Ezra Yisrael, there was a room on one. There was one room on each side where the Levium would store their instruments and practice and so forth. Here in the third Beis Hamikdash, instead, we're saying it's not going to be underground; it's going to be above ground. It's that thing shaped like a backwards E next to the northern gate. So here they drew it with the two rooms having a common wall. I'm not sure what the source for that is. I don't really see clearly any of the Mephoshim saying so in so many words, but okay, this is how they drew it. Anyway, the point is those two chambers are lishchos shorim. Those are the chambers for the singers where they're going to practice their singing and then keep their musical instruments and so forth. B'chotzer apnimi, it's in the inner chotzer, inside the Ezra's Koyanim / Ezra's Yisrael. Asher o'kesef sharat sofon, it's next to the northern gate. Ufneim derech hadorim, and those chambers, the openings of them, face towards the south. So you have over here, they're on the north side, and the openings of them face towards the south, towards the Mizbeach, because the Mizbeach, after all, is where they're going to be playing where they're going to be playing actually on the Duchan. You have, and in the middle of the page over there, you have that line running across underneath the Mizbeach is the Duchan. We're going to talk about it briefly in Perek Membez. So that's where they stand to play. So therefore, so their chambers face in that direction because that's the direction where they're going to be where they're going to be facing when they play. Echad or Kesef Shana Kodim. Then there's another chamber by the side of the eastern gate, Pnei Derech Hatzafon, and this one faces towards the north. So that's that little C-shaped one above the eastern gate, which is at the bottom of the page over there. You have that little C-shaped thing that faces towards the north. That, so he's going to explain in the next couple of psukim what these various chambers are for. Yes. Where they kept the chalil, not just the chalil and all the musical instruments, yeah. Was it was the E shape, and then the C shape one he's going to explain in a minute what that's for. By posik memhe, by dabre lai, by dabre loy, the malach speaks to me, zoi halishka asher panel derech adorim, this chamber that faces towards the south, meaning, in other words, that E shaped thing, lakoyanim shremim shmeres habayis, that will be for the koyanim who guard the guarding of the house. Now, what does that mean? Rashi says, it means actually, he says that apparently it means the Levim, the singers, because we just called it Lishchos Sharim, we called it chambers for the singers, and the Koyanim aren't the ones who sing in the Beis HaMikdash, the Levim are. So of necessity, this must be the same way as we find that sometimes the Koyanim are called Levim, as you have the Pasuk about Koyanim are Levim B'nei Tzadik, apparently here you have the other way around, where the Levim are being called Koyanim. In general, the word koyin literally means someone who serves. So therefore, we can be using it to refer to the Levim, where their service in the Beis HaMikdash is to sing. So though that chamber, or those two chambers, are reserved for them. We're calling it the chamber, even though we just said there were two. So Mitzvot David says it means this group of chambers. That Adak says maybe there's another one that wasn't mentioned. In any case, so that's reserved for the Levim. Now, the Malbim has an interesting point about it. He says, later on, we're going to talk about, in the next pasuk, and in more detail, Yechezkel talks about it, in Perek Mem Dalet, there had been many, many families of Koyanim who worshipped Avodah Zarah and helped other people worship Avodah Zarah during the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. They're going to be disqualified to serve as Koyanim, La'asid Lavay. They're going to be considered like Koyanim Bali Mum. They were able to eat from the korbanos, but not to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah, that's the halacha. A kohen who worships Avodah Zarah is not allowed to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Malbim says, maybe in fact what's going to happen is they're actually going to be considered more on the level of Levim, and therefore they're also going to be able to be among the singers in the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore maybe that's why the pasuk calls them lakohenim. It's interesting, you know, in Chassidus, we talk about the idea that the Levim of nowadays will be the Koyanim of La'asid Lavay because the world will be on a higher level and Gvura of the Levim will be shown to be higher than Chesed of the Koyanim. And here we have, it seems like almost the opposite, the other way around, that some Koyanim are going to be kind of downgraded to be Levim. Anyway, he continues, Pasuk Mem Vav, V'halishka shepanel derech hatzofen, as far as the chamber that faces towards the north, so that's the little C-shaped one on the bottom over there, L'koyanim shremer mishmeres ha-mizbeach. That will be for the koyanim who guard the guarding of the mizbeach, meaning those are the koyanim who are actually going to be doing the avodah on the mizbeach, so they have this chamber that they can use to do some of their avodah. So therefore, that's why it faces north, because the north is where the Kodesh Kodeshim are shechted. So therefore, so it faces in that direction. Who are these Kohenim? Heim of Neit Tzadik. They are the descendants of Tzadik. Tzadik was the Kohen Gadol in the times of David HaMelech and Shlomo. So he was the first Kohen Gadol who served in the actual Beis HaMikdash, as opposed to the Mishkan before that. So later on in Perek Mem Dalet, Yechezkel describes that his family stayed faithful to Hashem during all the years of the Bayis Rishon. In fact, all the Kohenim Gdolim of the first Beis HaMikdash all were descended from Tzadik. So I guess the Kohenim Gdolim were able to keep a tight rein on their family. And therefore, they're going to be the ones, he says, who we have it in the Haftarah, Parshas Emor, they're going to be the ones who are going to have the schus to do the actual Avodah in the third Beis HaMikdash. So they are the ones that crave me bnei Levi al Hashem l'shorosai, where they come close from among the whole Shevet Levi to Hashem to serve Him. They're going to be the ones for them. This chamber is reserved for them to use for whatever it is that they need to do in the Beis HaMikdash. Pasuk Mem Zayin vayomer sachotzer orach mea ama v'roichav mea ama merubas. He measured now the chotzer. Here we're talking about the inner chotzer where these various chambers and the mizbeach are located. It's 100 amos long and 100 amos wide, merubas, exactly square. v'hamizbeach lifnei abayis, and the mizbeach is directly in front of the bayis, meaning in front of the heichal. So I haven't yet been able to get a poster of this, but here you have the general view of it, where you have the chotzer apnimi in the middle over here is this hollow square, and in the middle of it you have the mizbeach. So now in the second Beis Mikdash, you have a multi-way machloikas in a number of gemaras where everybody agrees that from east to west the mizbeach was exactly centered in the azara. You have like this in the second Beis Mikdash, the whole azara is 187 amos long. The heichal itself takes up 100 amos of it, and you have 11 amos behind the heichal, so that accounts for 111 amos. That leaves 76. The footprint of the mizbeach on the floor is 32 amos. The yisoid is 32 amos. So that leaves 76 minus 32 leaves you 44. So it was exactly in the middle. You had 22 amos between the mizbeach and the ulam, and 22 amos between the other side of the mizbeach and the wall of the Ezras Yisrael. So as far as that, it was centered in that direction. As far as in the other direction, from north to south, there you have a several way machloikas in various gemaras. Was it also exactly in the middle between north and south? Was it more towards the? Was it completely in the northern half of the azara? Was it completely in the southern half of the azara? And the Rambam has a shita based apparently on a different girsa in one of those gemaras that says that it was mostly in the north, but a few amos of it stuck out into the south. So on the east-west axis, you have 44 amos left of floor space after you subtract the mizbeach. So they had 22 west of the mizbeach and 22 east of it. But when it comes to the width of the azara in the second Beis Mikdash was 135 amos. The mizbeach and the kevesh take up 62 amos of that. And you have several different opinions in the Gemara in various places. How exactly was it placed? Was that entire 62 amos in the north half of the azara? And in that case, the edge of the kevesh is only a few amos from the wall, only like 5 amos or so from the wall. Or is it completely, was a mizbeach completely in the northern half of the azara, and therefore you have from the northern wall of the mizbeach until the northern wall of the azara would be somewhere around 30 odd amos or so, and on the other side you'd have a nice large space between the end of the kevesh and the wall, or was it exactly in the middle? Right, exactly centered in front of the heichal, or the Rambam learns that it was mostly in the south, but a little bit sticking out into the north. The Rambam learns that the end of the kevesh was 12 and a half amos from the southern wall of the azara. That's in the second Beis Mikdash. Now in the third Beis Mikdash, he's saying v'amizbeach lifnei abayis, which seems to imply that it's exactly centered. So as a Tzuras Habayis, the Tosfos Yomtov, when he goes through and describes, he says exactly that. It is centered exactly in the middle. And so that's where the way it's drawn in this diagram. So in that case, it would come out. So the Chotzer Apnimis then is 100 amos wide. So if the Mizbeach, which is 32 amos, is exactly centered in the middle of it, then that leaves you 68 amos of space, 34 amos on each side. Then you have the kevesh is another 30 amos, so it comes out that the kevesh ends 4 amos from the southern entrance to the chotzer apnim. As far as the other dimension, again you have 30. You also have 34 amos between the mizbeach and the front of the ulam, and 34 amos from the mizbeach until the eastern wall of the chotzer apnim. Both Tzuras Habayis and the Malbim, when they discuss this, they both learn that the Duchan, again, the line that you have over here in the diagram, is exactly dividing that 34 Amos in two. So you have 17 Amos for the Ezras Kohanim and 17 for the Ezras Yisrael. Now, in the second Beis Mikdash, you had it was 11 and 11 Amos. Here you have 17 each. The Malbim actually points out, it comes out, therefore, in the third Beis Mikdash, there'll be more floor space than in the Ezras Yisrael than there was in the second Beis Mikdash. The second Beis Mikdash was 135 by 11, which comes out to less than 1,500 square amos. Here you're going to have, it's narrower because it's 100 amos, but it's wider because it's 17 amos instead of 11, and therefore we have 1,700 square amos of space. And the second Beis Mikdash was less than 1,500. 135 times 11 comes out to 1,485. So it comes out, even though the Chotzer Apnimi of the third Beis Mikdash is narrower than the Azara of the second Beis Mikdash, but the area that's available for the Ezra's Koinim and for the Ezra's Yisrael is larger, and so you have more room for Yisrael. So he continues, by Pasuk Memches, by the Eniel Ulam Abayis, then he brought me to the Ulam of the house. So now we're ready to enter into the entryway of the Heichel. The Heichel basically consists of three parts. You have the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you have the Kodesh, and in front of the Kodesh, you have the Ulam, which is an entryway. The Ulam itself consists, and this is similar to the second Beis Hamikdash, you have the middle of it, which is an open entryway into the Heichel. In fact, in the second Beis Hamikdash, in the Pashtus, that's how it'll be in the third as well. It didn't even have doors on it, just a poroichas for privacy. Then you have, there are wings sticking out on each side, 15 amas in each direction. We're going to talk about those. We're going to talk about those more in Perek Mem Aleph. That's usually how it's drawn. You usually find in diagrams of the second Beis Hamikdash that they draw it like that, that the Heichel is shaped kind of like a T. The Mishnah tells us in Midas it was wider in front and narrower in the back. And most diagrams that you'll see usually have it drawn like that. That's how it is on the Parochus over here as well, where you have like those wings that stick out 15 amos in each direction. And then the rest of it is straight walls. It is perpendicular walls all the way till the back. The Rambam actually learns in the second Beis Hamikdash it was different. He learns it was 100, and that later on the Pesukim, we're also going to have, even when we get to in the middle of Perek Mem Aleph, we're going to say the Heichel in third Beis Hamikdash is 100 amos wide in front and 70 in the back. Went up to the second Beis Hamikdash, was also like that. The Rambam learns and diagrams this way that it wasn't that you have 100 and then it all of a sudden goes to 70, but rather that it narrows smoothly from 100 down to 70. That's its shape like a trapezoid. Whether he would say the same thing is true of the third Beis Hamikdash, I don't know. He doesn't describe it. Anyway, so now Yechezkel says, by V'eniel Ulam Abayis, now he brought me into the Ulam, into the entryway into the Heichel. By Yomod El Ulam Chomish Amos Mipoi, V'chomish Amos Mipoi, he measured the doorposts 5 Amos in each direction, the doorposts being the thickness of the wall, the thickness of the front wall of the Ulam. And that front wall, by the way, is also the fourth wall of the Chotzer Apnimi. The Chotzer Apnimi had on three sides, you had the walls that separated from the Chotzer Achitzona that have the gates in them. The fourth wall is actually the front of the Heichel. So he measured the thickness of that wall when you're going into the Ulam is 5 amas on each side, the Roich of Ashar, Shalosh Amas Mipoi, the Shalosh Amas Mipoi, and the width of the doorway is 3 amas on each side, meaning Rashi says that the Ulam itself is 20 amas wide, as he's going to say in the next pasuk, but so in the first, in the second Beis Hamikdash, and maybe in the first as well, that 20 amas was completely open. Here in the third Beis Hamikdash, instead, it's going to be 3 amos on each side of it. It's closed, and the doorway itself, therefore, is only going to be 14 amos wide. So you're going to have, in other words, you have the wall is coming from the sides over there, and you have, if you stand inside the Ulam looking outward, you will see 3 amos of wall on each side of you, and then 14 amos of doorway in the middle, where in the second Beis Hamikdash, you would have seen no walls on this in front of you on the sides at all, and just 20 amos straight open to the outside. And he continues, Orach Ulam Esrimama, the length of the Ulam, meaning the longer dimension of it from north to south. Esrimama is 20 amas wide. The Roich of Ashtar Esrimama, the width of it, meaning the shorter dimension from east to west as you're going into the Heichel, is 11 amas. Over Malas Ashayalu Elov, and you went up to it by steps. In the second Beis Hamikdash, there were 12 steps there to go up to it. So here in the third Beis Hamikdash, it'll be similar. In the second Beis Hamikdash, as we said, you had 22 amas space within the Mizbeach and the Ulam. Here you have 34 amas space, but whether the steps will be the same size, I don't know. And then he says there are pillars by the doorposts, one on either side. By the first Beis Hamikdash, it describes in Malachim, you have the Yochin and Boaz pillars that Shlomo set up, which represent the stability and the continuity of Malchus Beis David, Yochin, that it should be established, Boaz, that there's strength in it. The Pesukim describe how those were destroyed by the first Beis Hamikdash. In fact, the Pesukim in Yirmiya takes special care to mention even how they were constructed, showing how important they were in the second Beis Hamikdash, whether they had them or not, doesn't say. But now Yechezkel is telling us there will be the equivalent of them in the third Beis Hamikdash. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGa'ula, Chaf Gimel Tammuz. The Zohar, we know, says that the base of the Bayis Shlishi will be built by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Zohar calls it Binyonet HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rashi says the same thing, that it'll come Min HaShemayim. And then on the other hand, we find Chazal telling us that it'll be built by Bnei Yisrael. And we know that Rambam says Mashiach Bona Mikdash. The Pashtus, the reason is, the Rebbe says, look, I mean, building the Bais HaMikdash is a mitzvah saseh, and a mitzvah saseh is something that's incumbent on all the Jews, so then he's going to, we'll continue tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, and talking about how to reconcile various ways to reconcile these two possibilities. Continuing on Halachas of Tefillas HaDerech, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says you have to say Tefillas HaDerech next to another bracha, because after all, it doesn't begin Baruch Atah Hashem. The Alter Rebbe phrases it, Toiv la'smicha la'ez bracha. It's good to put it after another bracha. So therefore, for example, a person's leaving in the morning and says Birkas HaShachar, or he stayed overnight in the city, and then he's saying Tefillas HaDerech before he leaves, then he could say it after the bracha, Grei Mochsadim Tavim Lam Yisrael. If it's later in the day, then he should eat or drink something on the way, make a bracha achrona, and then say Tefillas HaDerech, or go to the bathroom and say Asher Yotzer, and then after that, Tefillas HaDerech. Now, we have examples, for example, when the Rebbe traveled up to Gan Yisrael, and I think you have such things that are brought in Binas Desha and other such Sfarim, that the Rebbe did one of those things in order to be able to say Tefillas HaDerech Samuch to another bracha.
Say on Shabbos?
No, we don't say it on Shabbos.
Okay.